Welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. I'm your host, Alan Wolin.
If you search for tenderness, it isn't hard to find. You can have the love you need to live. But if you look for truthfulness, you might just as well be blind. It always seems to be so hard to give. Honesty is such a lonely word. Everyone is so untrue. Honesty is hardly ever heard, and mostly what I need from you.
I was still in high school when Billy Joel released Honesty back in 1978. I can't tell you how lucky I feel to have been alive while Billy Joel was releasing his music. What a feeling it was to experience him churning out hit after hit after hit in real time. Just the other day, I was in my car, stuck in LA traffic, and I was introducing my 12-year-old daughter to some of Billy Joel's best songs. And after hearing a few, she asked me, "Does he have any songs which aren't depressing?" Her question stopped me in my tracks because I never thought of Billy Joel's music as depressing. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that almost all of his music is indeed imbued with a tragic sensibility. Life is hard. Relationships are hard. People will disappoint you. You will disappoint yourself. And perhaps it was precisely Billy Joel's tragic vision of life, which so many people have connected with over the decades. I know that was a big part of his appeal to me. It just felt honest. And it is probably no coincidence that I find Thomas Sowell's tragic vision of human nature compelling to my intellect in the same way I find Billy Joel's tragic stories and music so compelling to my soul. In today's episode, I would like to explore the theme of honesty. Sowell wrote about honesty in his latest book, Social Justice Fallacies, and also in his 2000 classic, Basic Economics. In addition, his 1993 collection of essays called Is Reality Optional? Contains an essay about honesty, which has a very surprising spin to it, which I think you are going to appreciate. What does honesty have to do with social justice and with economics, you might ask? Turns out a lot, according to Sowell. We will be exploring Sowell's writings on honesty here, and I will play several clips from those three books in this episode. While thinking deeply about honesty, I wanted to see what other intellectuals wrote about the subject, and it turns out that my favorite behavioral economist wrote the definitive book on the subject. His name is Dan Ariely, and his book is called The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves, which was published in 2012. Professor Ariely will be joining me later in this episode to shed light on Sowell's views about honesty and on honesty in general. I've chosen some classic Billy Joel songs as the theme music of this episode, not only because the best song about honesty ever written came from him, but also because Billy Joel's tragic lyrics are just so in sync with Sowell's tragic vision of human nature, I can't resist. As always, my main goal with this podcast is to introduce more and more people to the ideas of Thomas Sowell. In this episode, I have two additional goals. The first is to introduce people to the musical genius of Billy Joel, and, if they already know and appreciate his work, to deepen that appreciation with the beauty and depth of his lyrics. Part of me hopes that there are people listening to the podcast who aren't really that familiar with Billy Joel, and that this episode might serve as their springboard into his musical genius. You know, the next generation. My third goal with this episode is to introduce you to the ideas of Dan Ariely. For the most part, I only invite people onto the podcast whose work I know, admire, and recommend. Dan Ariely is one of those people. I'll tell you more about him and his work a little later in this episode. So let's get started with this powerful cover of Billy Joel's Honesty, performed by the elementary school chorus of PS 22 in Staten Island, New York. I'll put a link in the show notes to the original video. The first girl you see in the video was named Honesty by her parents, spelled with an I. In his 2023 book, Social Justice Fallacies, Sowell included a short but potent discussion on the subject of honesty, which is consequential enough, I believe, to be teased out into its own full-length book. Here's what Sowell had to say in that book.
Environment cannot be defined as simply the current tangible surroundings, nor can human capital be defined as simply education or skills. Qualities such as honesty are not only moral virtues for individuals, but human capital for communities, their cultures, and their economies, where geographic setting offers only limited and isolated patches of marginally fertile land that can sustain only small communities living close to the margins of subsistence. There is little to gain from deception and everything to lose if the people in that environment do not stick together and be honest with one another for the sake of the mutual trust and cooperation required for their survival in circumstances where survival is by no means secure. People living for centuries in small, poor, and isolated communities with neither police forces nor fire departments know that any emergency can become a catastrophe unless they all stick together and come to each other's rescue. Such circumstances, obvious to those who live in these circumstances, can promote honesty and cooperation more than any preaching or laws. Other people in very different and more favorable circumstances may or may not develop a comparable sense of honesty and cooperation. In short, honesty is one of many factors that cannot be assumed to be equally present in all places or among all peoples, nor does empirical evidence suggest any quality in this factor any more than in many other factors. Among the simple tests used to assess the honesty in various peoples and places have been projects that deliberately left wallets containing both money and personal identification in public places in various cities around the world. When one such project in 2013 left a dozen wallets in public places in various cities, the number of wallets returned with the money still in them varied from 11 out of 12 in Helsinki, Finland, to 1 out of 12 in Lisbon, Portugal. Moreover, the one wallet that was returned in Lisbon was returned by a couple visiting from the Netherlands. No Portuguese returned any. An earlier test found 100% of the wallets returned in Norway, 67% in the United States, 30% returned in China, and 21% returned in Mexico. A different test of honesty was a 5-year study of which United Nations diplomats paid their parking tickets in New York City, where diplomatic immunity shielded them from prosecution. Egypt, with 24 UN diplomats, had thousands of unpaid parking tickets during that 5-year period. Meanwhile, Canada, with the same number of UN diplomats as Egypt, had no unpaid parking tickets at all during that same 5-year period. Nor did Britain, with 31 UN diplomats, or Japan, with 47 UN diplomats. John Stuart Mill pointed out in the 19th century that the level of honesty or dishonesty in a society was a major factor in the development of its economy. Using the high level of corruption in Russia as an example, Mill concluded that it must be an immense drag on the capabilities of economical improvement. Since then, whether under the Tsars, the Communists, or in post-Communist Russia, corruption has been pervasive. At one time, some individuals were described by fellow Russians as being as honest as a German, a tacit admission that such qualities were not nearly as common among Russians. Conversely, the Industrial Revolution in England was aided by investments from foreign countries whose investors were able to rely on the reputation of British law for honesty and impartiality. There is no more reason to expect all individuals, groups, or nations to be equally honest than there is to expect them to have the same skills, the same wealth, or the same IQs. Even in countries with widespread corruption, where what has been called the radius of trust seldom extends beyond the nuclear family, there can be particular groups who have sufficient trust among themselves that they can conduct business on the basis of verbal agreements without recourse to unreliable legal systems. Marwaris in India and various subgroups among the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia have even been able to engage in international trade with members of their own groups in other countries on the basis of verbal understandings. This can be an enormous competitive economic advantage in countries with unreliable legal and political institutions when indigenous rivals have to be far more cautious about economic transactions. But even in a country with more reliable institutions, there are advantages in being able, as Hasidic Jews in New York are, to give each other consignments of jewels to sell and share the profits on the basis of verbal agreements. Whatever the level of honesty in a given society, there is no reason to expect existing disparities in these respects to remain the same forever when so many other things have changed over the centuries. But at any given time, honesty is one of the many factors that vary, making equal chances for all very unlikely.
Sowell makes three key points in this clip. Point number one. Honesty is not just a moral virtue, it's also a form of human capital that varies greatly from culture to culture and from group to group within a particular culture. Point number two. The radius of trust enjoyed by a group of people can either impede or facilitate their economic growth. If a group enjoys a radius of trust which does not extend beyond the nuclear family, then that group can only achieve so much, as compared with groups whose radius of trust extends to all members of the group or to the wider society, and not just to members of the immediate family. Point number three. Sowell gives us three examples of subcultures which enjoy high levels of honesty within their groups, as well as high levels of wealth relative to the larger society: the Marwaris of India, the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia, and the Hasidic Jews in New York City. These groups couldn't be more different in background and culture, and yet their wide and deep radii of trust at least partially explains their economic successes as compared with the societies in which they are but tiny minorities. As Billy Joel sings in his 1986 hit song, A Matter of Trust, I've lived long enough to have learned, the closer you get to the fire, the more you get burned. But that won't happen to us, because it's always been a question of trust. Twenty-three years before he wrote Social Justice Fallacies, Sowell explored the subject of honesty in his best-selling book, Basic Economics. Sowell said this:
order includes more than laws and the government apparatus that administers laws. It also includes the honesty, reliability, and cooperativeness of the people themselves. Honesty and reliability can vary greatly between one country and another. As a knowledgeable observer put it, while it is unimaginable to do business in China without paying bribes, to offer one in Japan is the greatest of faux pas.
Sowell explains why economic activity is inhibited by the lack of honesty. He says this:
where neither the honesty of the general population nor the integrity of the legal system can be relied upon, economic activities are inhibited, if not stifled. At the same time, groups whose members can rely on each other, such as the Marwaris, have a great advantage in competition with others, in being able to secure mutual cooperation in economic activities which extend over distance and time, activities that would be far more risky for others in such societies, and still more so for foreigners.
Sowell goes deeper into the example of Hasidic Jews in New York City to explain why maintaining a reputation for honesty can be so crucial within small communities.
Like the Marwaris in India, Hasidic Jews in New York's Diamond District often give consignments of jewels to one another and share the sales proceeds on the basis of verbal agreements among themselves. The extreme social isolation of the Hasidic community from the larger society and even from other Jews makes it very costly for anyone who grows up in that community to disgrace his family and lose his own standing, as well as his own economic and social relationships, by cheating on an agreement with a fellow Hasidim.
When a culture finds itself limited by a radius of trust which is so short that only members of one's family can be trusted, this dramatically impedes economic activity. Why? Because business owners don't trust their own employees. Sowell quotes NYU professor William Easterly, who wrote this:
Malagasy grain traders carry out inspections of each lot of grain in person because they don't trust employees. One third of the traders say they don't hire more workers because of fear of theft by them. This limits the grain trader's firm size, cutting short a trader's potential success. In many countries, companies tend to be family enterprises because family members are the only ones felt trustworthy. So the size of the company is then limited by the size of the family.
We are all very familiar with this concept of the radius of trust, though we may never have heard or used that term. We see examples of trust, or its lack thereof, all around us. Security guards in retail stores, heavy and expensive metal grates and fences to protect businesses, heavy or light police presences in varied environments, security checks at airports, security deposits for leased items, requirements to pay for things in advance, and many more. When I was thinking about the concept of radius of trust, I thought about youth gangs like the Crips and the Bloods, and also criminal gangs like the Italian Mafia. When I think about these groups from an economic perspective, it occurs to me that they perform a valuable function for groups attempting to survive and thrive in unstable environments. Namely, they enable the group to enjoy and benefit from a radius of trust which extends beyond the nuclear family. Let's take the Italian Mafia, for example. The Mafia developed an entire structure of intrafamilial relationships and rules wherein complex business arrangements could be consummated without the need for legal contracts and other external controls. The TV series The Sopranos provided millions of viewers around the world with a gripping portrayal of the complex systems enjoyed by the Italian Mafia living in the United States. Who among us doesn't find this system fascinating? I don't know about you, but hearing the Sopranos theme music gives me goosebumps. What a great show that was.
What's up, T? My future brother-in-law's caused a serious problem.
How serious?
Well, he's not satisfied with the current leadership. He wants to have me popped.
That motherfucker.
So now I gotta decide what to do about him.
genuinely don't think there's anything to gain by keeping him around.
Get it done.
I'm no fan of the mafia, but I can see that it played an important role in societies in which people could not depend on the government to enforce basic justice. When Tony and his wise guy associates ran a neighborhood, that neighborhood was safe and relatively clean, and there were no squatters, that's for sure. According to Sowell, governments cannot create honesty directly, but they can create dishonesty indirectly. Sowell says this:
honesty is more than a moral principle. It is also a major economic factor. While government can do little to create honesty directly, in various ways it can indirectly either support or undermine the traditions on which honest conduct is based. This it can do by what it teaches in its schools, by the examples set by public officials, or by the laws that it passes. These laws can create incentives toward either moral or immoral conduct. Where laws create a situation where the only way to avoid ruinous losses is by violating the law, the government is in effect reducing public respect for laws in general, as well as rewarding specific dishonest behavior. When laws and policies make honesty increasingly costly, then government is, in effect, promoting dishonesty. Such dishonesty can then extend beyond the particular laws and policies in question to a more general habit of disobeying laws, to the detriment of the whole economy and society.
In Basic Economics, Sowell gives a particular example of how government policies can encourage dishonesty: rent control laws. This is a very interesting example, and not one which would have occurred to me on my own. Sowell says this:
advocates of rent control, for example, often point to examples of dishonest behavior among landlords to demonstrate an apparent need for both rent control itself and for related tenants' rights legislation. However, rent control laws can widen the difference between the value of a given apartment building to honest owners and dishonest owners. Where the costs of legally mandated services, heat, maintenance, hot water, are high enough to equal or exceed the amount of rent permitted under the law, the value of a building to an honest landlord can become zero or even negative. Yet, to a landlord who is willing to violate the law and save money by neglecting required services, or who accepts bribes from prospective tenants during a housing shortage under rent control, the building may still have some value. Where something has different values to different people, it tends to move through the marketplace to its most valued use, which is where the bids will be highest. In this case, dishonest landlords can easily bid apartment buildings away from honest landlords, some of whom may be relieved to escape the bind that rent control puts them in. Landlords willing to resort to arson may find the building most valuable of all if they can sell the site for commercial or industrial use after burning the building down, thereby getting rid of both tenants and rent control.
In his 1993 collection of essays called Is Reality Optional?, Sowell presents another angle to the subject of honesty which caught me by surprise. I find it fascinating and gripping. Here's what he said.
Who watches the watchdogs? That is the big question raised by the recent $400 million out-of-court settlement by the accounting firm of Ernst & Young, which federal agencies claimed had not done a good job of auditing some of the shaky financial institutions whose collapse is costing the taxpayers billions. Because this was an out-of-court settlement, the validity of the charges remains unsubstantiated. Clearly, however, either the auditors or the federal agencies which audited the auditors were wrong. In short, layers upon layers of watchdogs do not guarantee effective monitoring. The implications reach far beyond accounting, and in fact, far beyond the kind of society we live in. One of the big differences between societies is in how they meet the need for monitoring. Often the most effective monitoring is self-monitoring. That is a major part of the case for private property, for example. Both owner-operators of businesses and private homeowners typically work longer and harder on their private property than is required by any external authorities. In the criminal law, police are only a kind of backup system for those who are not effectively monitored by their own consciences. If the whole notion of right and wrong erodes away, as avant-garde educators seem to wish, the police cannot possibly do the whole job of keeping order. Indeed, the police themselves would have no reason to resist being corrupt.
In this passage, Sowell makes the point that the most effective form of monitoring is self-monitoring. An honest person monitors himself and does not need to be monitored by third parties. When almost everyone in a society is honest, we call this a high-trust society. Sowell continues.
The self-monitoring of conscience means that even people whose wrongdoing has been successfully concealed from everyone else have been known to return money they owed, to confess to unsolved crimes, and in some cases, even mete out a death penalty by committing suicide for their secret misdeeds. Self-monitoring is reinforced by mutual monitoring among people with emotional ties to one another, where the whole family bears the stigma of the individual member's vice, as among the Japanese. The pressures can be enormous to avoid anything that would bring disgrace upon your own flesh and blood. Similar pressures operate in close-knit communities. Chinese businessmen in various Southeast Asian countries often make deals with one another by verbal agreement, because default would mean social ruin and family disgrace. Hasidic Jews in New York are able to give one another gems to sell on consignment, without the need for legal papers, because their strong social and moral ties are more effective than legal processes would be. The degree to which such social pressures are effective varies from one group to another and from one society to another. More honest societies can extend more credit, collect taxes more efficiently, create more joint ventures, use fewer resources for security, and enjoy higher standards of living as a result.
In this essay, Sowell provides an interesting spin on the subject of honesty. Namely, that honesty in a culture promotes economic activity, not just because people can rely on each other more, but also, and possibly primarily, because honest people monitor their own behavior and tremendous costs can be saved by the whole society in not having to implement expensive systems of third-party monitoring in order to keep the majority of people in line. If you've ever lived in or visited a rough neighborhood, you might have noticed that liquor stores are built in such a way that the customers cannot touch the bottles until they have purchased them. The entire inventory sits behind a plexiglass barrier, and the customers have to ask a salesperson, who also sits behind the barrier, to sell them what they want. This is the perfect visual metaphor for the inefficiencies and hidden costs of low-trust societies, where people cannot be counted on to monitor their own behavior. I think it's clear from everything Sowell has written on this subject that honesty is a lot more than simply a moral virtue. It is also a crucial economic factor which can make or break a society in so many ways. So now that we've heard what Thomas Sowell has to say about the subject of honesty, let's turn our attention to the work of Professor Dan Ariely and his book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, published in 2012. Dan Ariely has been a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University since 2008. Prior to that, he taught behavioral economics at MIT. I first discovered Ariely in 2008 with the publication of his very successful first book, Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. This book launched my interest in the field of behavioral economics, and I've been a fan of the genre ever since. I read Ariely's second book, The Upside of Irrationality, in 2010, and also his third book, which is the subject of this podcast, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves, which was published in 2012. The basic thesis of Ariely's book about honesty is that we all lie, and that lying is a constant of human nature. This tragic vision of human nature stands in stark contrast to the more utopian vision of human nature, which holds that there are good people who don't lie and bad people who do lie, and that with the proper moral education, we could be more like the former and less like the latter. Or, as Santa might say, some people are naughty while others are nice. Ariely quotes Groucho Marx in his book, who has this somewhat harsh admonition to offer us.
There's one way to find out if a man is honest. Ask him. If he says yes, he is a crook. Groucho Marx.
According to Ariely, there are two competing models for understanding why and how people lie. On the one hand, there is the rational model of dishonesty, which holds that people weigh the pros and cons of lying and act according to a rational calculation of what they stand to gain through lying versus the price they might have to pay if they are caught. Ariely explains.
In rational economics, the prevailing notion of cheating comes from the University of Chicago economist Gary Becker, a Nobel laureate who suggested that people commit crimes based on a rational analysis of each situation. As Tim Harford describes in his book, The Logic of Life, the birth of this theory was quite mundane. One day, Becker was running late for a meeting, and thanks to a scarcity of legal parking, decided to park illegally and risk a ticket. Becker contemplated his own thought process in this situation, and noted that his decision had been entirely a matter of weighing the conceivable cost, being caught, fined, and possibly towed, against the benefit of getting to the meeting in time. He also noted that in weighing the costs versus the benefits, there was no place for consideration of right or wrong. It was simply about the comparison of possible positive and negative outcomes. And thus, the simple model of rational crime, SMORC, was born. According to this model, we all think and behave pretty much as Becker did. Like your average mugger, we all seek our own advantage as we make our way through the world. Whether we do this by robbing banks or writing books is inconsequential to our rational calculations of costs and benefits.
The other model of dishonesty, which competes with this rational model, is that virtually everyone lies, but mostly within certain limits. People will lie up to a certain degree, but only so much that they can still think of themselves as reasonably honest. Ariely says this.
Rather, it shows that our sense of our own morality is connected to the amount of cheating we feel comfortable with. Essentially, we cheat up to the level that allows us to retain our self-image as reasonably honest individuals.
There are two sports which are known to bring out the liar in us all: golf and fishing. Ariely shares this fisherman story to drive home the point.
I knew a young man once. He was a most conscientious fellow, and when he took to fly fishing, he determined never to exaggerate his hauls by more than 25%. "When I have caught 40 fish," said he, "then I will tell people that I have caught 50, and so on. But I will not lie any more than that, because it is sinful to lie." Although most people haven't consciously figured out, much less announced, their acceptable rate of lying like this young man, this overall approach seems to be quite accurate. Each of us has a limit to how much we can cheat before it becomes absolutely sinful.
Ariely tells another memorable story about how we compartmentalize our own lying within careful limits. Here's the pencil story.
8-year-old Jimmy comes home from school with a note from his teacher that says, "Jimmy stole a pencil from the student sitting next to him." Jimmy's father is furious. He goes to great lengths to lecture Jimmy and let him know how upset and disappointed he is, and he grounds the boy for 2 weeks. "And just wait until your mother comes home," he tells the boy ominously. Finally, he concludes, "Anyway, Jimmy, if you needed a pencil, why didn't you just say something? Why didn't you simply ask? You know very well that I can bring you dozens of pencils from work." If we smirk at this joke, it's because we recognize the complexity of human dishonesty that is inherent to all of us.
The subject of honesty has come up a lot recently, especially with regard to academia. The Claudine Gay scandal at Harvard University has made us aware that many academics are getting caught having plagiarized in their scholarly writing, which is a big no-no in academia. To illustrate the point, Ariely tells us about the famous Princeton Honor Code.
Princeton University has a rigorous honor system that's been around since 1893. Incoming freshmen receive a copy of the Honor Code Constitution and a letter from the Honor Committee about the honor system, which they must sign before they can matriculate. They also attend mandatory talks about the importance of the Honor Code during their first week of school. Following the lectures, the incoming Princetonians further discuss the system with their dorm advising group. As if that weren't enough, one of the campus music groups, the Triangle Club, performs its Honor Code song for the incoming class. For the rest of their time at Princeton, students are repeatedly reminded of the Honor Code. They sign an Honor Code at the end of every paper they submit. This paper represents my own work in accordance with university regulations. They sign another pledge for every exam, test, or quiz. I pledge my honor that I have not violated the Honor Code during this examination. And they receive biannual reminder emails from the Honor Committee.
In this clip, Ariely mentions that there is even an Honor Code song at Princeton. And you know me, once I hear there is a song, I feel compelled to investigate further. It turns out that the song dates back to 1995 and was written by a then Princeton student named Peter Mills. I tracked Peter down using the Google, and I even corresponded with him about his song. I thought you might enjoy it. The lyrics are fun and wholesome. Finished the test, gave it your best. Each T has its cross, each I has its dot. Quadruple checked, it's all correct, but there's something that you forgot. I pledge my honor that I have not violated the honor code during this examination. This is the promise you make on each and every test you take. Take a minute to sign the honor pledge. The song continues with a dig into competing Ivy League schools, which don't have an explicit honor pledge. Harvard and Yale look pretty pale, because if you go there, it's okay to cheat. We've got an edge. It's called the pledge, and we think it's really neat.
Finish the test, gave it your best. Each T has its cross, each I has its dot. Quadruple check, it's all correct, but there's something that you forgot. I pledge my honor that I have not violated the honor code during this examination. That is the promise you make on each and every test you take.
So we've learned that some, and possibly many, of our academic leaders have plagiarized in their scholarly work. In other words, they quote-unquote stole ideas from other scholars and pretended these were their own ideas without crediting the original source of the ideas. I think we can all understand why this is not a good idea. But does academic deception go even deeper? Ariely tells us this story.
Or consider the case of Mary Lee Jones, who co-authored a popular guidebook called Less stress, more success, a new approach to guiding your teen through college admissions and beyond, in which, among other things, she advocated being yourself in order to be successful in college admissions and job searches. She was MIT's popular dean of admissions, and for 25 years, by all accounts, she did her job very well. There was just one problem. She had added several fictitious degrees to her resume to land that job in the first place. It was an act of cheating, pure and simple. The irony of her fall from grace was not lost on Jones, who apologized for not having the courage to correct the mistakes on her fake resume at any point during her employment. When an extremely popular advocate of being yourself is toppled by false credentials, what are the rest of us to think?
I can tell you from personal experience that faking academic degrees is much easier than people realize. For example, I have a BA from the University of Pennsylvania and an MBA from New York University. Good for me, right? Well, I have put those credentials on my resume for many decades now, and not a single soul has ever asked me for proof of those degrees. Nor have I ever shown proof of them to anyone, ever. In fact, if someone were to ask me for proof, I don't even know what I would show them. I never saved either of the diplomas. Here's Dan Ariely talking with Yoel Inbar about a prominent case of academic dishonesty from a university in the Netherlands.
In this program, Dan talks with Yoel Inbar of Tilburg University about the high cost of cheating in the academic world.
Recently in Tilburg, there was this case about academic dishonesty. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could kind of describe in short what was the case of this dishonesty, and then I want to ask you a few questions about it.
Yeah, so really briefly, Diederik Stoppel, who was a dean and a professor here, he was a well-known researcher in social psychology, had won numerous awards, was well-respected, had published in the best journals, gotten a lot of grant money. He was found to have made up, well, at least the majority of data of his data in the last 5 years, perhaps going back even further than that. So it wasn't that he collected data and then altered it to look better. It was that he just made it up out of whole cloth, just sat down and invented this data.
And you say it wasn't just. So what are you referring to? That the practice of kind of trimming data is more acceptable than making up whole new data sets?
Well, I think if you look at this sort of stuff on a continuum, there's stuff that maybe we acknowledge that some people do, but that we wouldn't want to call outright fraud. So, for example, that might be like optional stopping. So you look at your data, does it look good? Then you stop. Does it not quite look good? Then you still run another 20. Mm-hmm. Now, this is something that we can agree as a field that's not a good thing for us to do. On the other hand,
just
it's
to
not
be clear,
something we
run
would call
run,
outright fraud, right?
Yeah, just to be clear, run around another 20, you mean continue running more participants in the study.
Exactly.
So you have,
exactly
you have a study,
right.
You stop, the data doesn't look good, you continue running studies, but if the data look good, you stop there. And because
you
of that, your
then,
stopping point
yes.
might influence what's going on. And that's, it's dishonest, but we don't think of it as something that somebody is actually planning in advance.
Exactly.
While what Diederik did seemed to be, I mean, there's no other interpretation, but he actually went ahead and made up data.
Right.
So sat there with an Excel spreadsheet to just enter what people would have responded and pretended people actually responded this way.
So it seems that academics have been known to fudge data in a wide spectrum of ways, from slanting their studies to give them the results they want, to outright faking all the data in the first place. I don't know about you, but I'm not surprised. Given all the social activism dominating academia over the last 50 years, whereby many academics view their mission as one of guiding our society to utopia, rather than the more mundane, just figuring out the truth. How boring is the whole truth thing anyway? How old-fashioned? Apparently, we can't let the truth get in the way of us getting things done. But before you think it's just the professors who are lying and cheating, listen to this story about the dead granny phenomenon, which shows how students play their part as well.
Over the course of many years of teaching, I've noticed that there typically seems to be a rash of deaths among students' relatives at the end of the semester, and it happens mostly in the week before final exams and before papers are due. In an average semester, about 10% of my students come to me asking for an extension because someone has died, usually a grandmother. Of course, I find it very sad, and I'm always ready to sympathize with my students and give them more time to complete their assignments. But the question remains, what is it about the weeks before finals that is so dangerous to students' relatives? Most professors encounter the same puzzling phenomenon, and I'll guess that we have come to suspect some kind of causal relationship between exams and sudden deaths among grandmothers. In fact, one intrepid researcher has successfully proven it. After collecting data over several years, Mike Adams, a professor of biology at Eastern Connecticut State University, has shown that grandmothers are 10 times more likely to die before a midterm and 19 times more likely to die before a final exam. Moreover, grandmothers of students who aren't doing so well in class are at even higher risk. Students who are failing are 50 times more likely to lose a grandmother compared with non-failing students. In a paper exploring this sad connection, Adams speculates that the phenomenon is due to intrafamilial dynamics, which is to say, students' grandmothers care so much about their grandchildren that they worry themselves to death over the outcome of exams. This would indeed explain why fatalities occur more frequently as the stakes rise, especially in cases where a student's academic future is in peril. With this finding in mind, it is rather clear that from a public policy perspective, grandmothers, particularly those of failing students, should be closely monitored for signs of ill health during the weeks before and during finals. Another recommendation is that their grandchildren, again particularly the ones who are not doing well in class, should not tell their grandmothers anything about the timing of the exams or how they are performing in class. Though it is likely that intrafamilial dynamics cause this tragic turn of events, there is another possible explanation for the plague that seems to strike grandmothers twice a year. It may have something to do with students' lack of preparation and their subsequent scramble to buy more time than with any real threat to the safety of those dear old women. If that is the case, we might want to ask why it is that students become so susceptible to losing their grandmothers in emails to professors at semester's end. Perhaps at the end of the semester, the students become so depleted by the months of studying and burning the candle at both ends that they lose some of their morality, and in the process also show disregard for their grandmothers' lives. If the concentration it takes to remember a longer digit can send people running for chocolate cake, it's not hard to imagine how dealing with months of cumulative material from several classes might lead students to fake a dead grandmother in order to ease the pressure. Not that that's an excuse for lying to one's professors.
I think we can all fully understand that human beings lie for their own personal gain. No surprise here. But did you know that there's also a form of lying called altruistic lying, where we lie for the benefit of others? One form of altruistic lying that is very familiar to us is the so-called white lie, wherein we lie to spare someone else's feelings. Most of us endorse this form of dishonesty, I believe, as a way to get along better with others and lubricate our social interactions. Arielli gives us this example.
When we lie for another person's benefit, we call it a white lie. When we tell a white lie, we're expanding the fudge factor, but we're not doing it for selfish reasons. For example, consider the importance of insincere compliments. We all know the gold standard of white lies, in which a woman who is less than svelte puts on a slinky new dress and asks her husband, "Do I look fat in this?" The husband does a quick cost-benefit analysis. He sees his whole life pass before his eyes if he answers with the brutal truth. So he tells her, "Darling, you look beautiful." Another evening, marriage saved.
But there's another form of altruistic lying which is far more insidious and can lead to many social problems. Arielli calls it the Robin Hood phenomenon. He explains,
"This tendency to care about others can also make it possible to be more dishonest in situations where acting unethically will benefit others. From this perspective, we can think about cheating when others are involved as altruistic, where, like Robin Hood, we cheat because we are good people who care about the welfare of those around us."
By conducting cheating experiments on real people, Arielli was able to demonstrate that in many cases, people cheat even more than usual when other people stand to benefit, even when they don't personally know those other people. Arielli says this.
"Do you think people in this situation would cheat more than they did in the individual shredder condition? Here's what we found. When participants learned that both they and someone else would benefit from their dishonesty if they exaggerated their scores more, they ended up engaging in even higher levels of cheating. claiming to have solved three more matrices than when they were cheating just for themselves. This result suggests that we humans have a weakness for altruistic cheating, even if we barely know the person who might benefit from our misbehavior. Sadly, it seems that even altruism can have a dark side.
Ariely continues.
To look into purely altruistic cheating, we introduced a condition in which the fruit of each participant's cheating would benefit only their partner. What did we find? As it turns out, altruism is indeed a strong motivator for cheating. When cheating was carried out for purely altruistic reasons, and the cheaters themselves did not gain anything from their act, overclaiming increased to an even larger degree. Why might this be the case? I think that when both we and another person stand to benefit from our dishonesty, we operate out of a mix of selfish and altruistic motives. In contrast, when other people, and only other people, stand to benefit from our cheating, we find it far easier to rationalize our bad behavior in purely altruistic ways, and subsequently, we further relax our moral inhibitions. After all, if we are doing something for the pure benefit of others, aren't we indeed a little bit like Robin Hood? Based on these results, we could speculate that people who work for ideological organizations, such as political groups and not-for-profits, might actually feel more comfortable bending moral rules, because they are doing it for a good cause and to help others.
Reading Ariely's book has made it clear to me that there's a lot more to the subject of dishonesty than I had originally thought. The black and white, naughty versus nice Santa Claus model of honesty doesn't paint the whole picture. Sowell draws a connection between the general level of honesty in a society and the economic and social success of that society. Ariely explores this subject in his book, and he asks himself this question. Does honesty vary from country to country and from culture to culture? What he discovered might surprise you. Ariely says this.
I travel a lot, which means that I get to meet people from all over the world, and when I do, I often ask them about honesty and morality in their countries. As a result, I'm beginning to understand how cultural differences, whether regional, national, or corporate, contribute to dishonesty. If you grew up outside the United States, think about this for a moment. Do people from your home country cheat more or less than Americans do? After asking many people from various countries this question, I've discovered that people have very strong beliefs about cheating in their own countries, and most believe that people in their home country cheat more than Americans do, with the somewhat predictable exception of people from Canada and the Nordic countries. Understanding that these are only subjective impressions, I was curious to see whether there really was something to them. So I decided to test some of these cultural perceptions more directly. In order to explore cultural differences, we first had to come up with a way to equate the financial incentives across the various locations. If we always paid, for example, an amount equivalent to $1 for a correctly solved question, this would range from being a very high payment in some places to a rather low one in others. Our first idea of how to equate the size of the incentives was to use a product that would be internationally recognized, such as a McDonald's hamburger. Following this approach, for each matrix solved correctly, participants could receive one quarter of the cost of a McDonald's hamburger in that location. This approach assumed that the people setting prices at McDonald's understand the economic buying power in each location and set their prices accordingly. In the end, we decided on a related approach and used the beer index. We set up shop in local bars and paid participants one quarter of the cost of a pint of beer for every matrix that they claimed to have solved. To make sure that our participants were sober, we only approached bargoers as they were entering the bar. Because I grew up in Israel, I especially wanted to see how Israelis measured up. I admit that I suspected that Israelis would cheat more than Americans. But as it turned out, our Israeli participants cheated in the matrix experiments just as much as the Americans. We decided to check other nationalities too. Shirley Wang, one of my Chinese collaborators, was convinced that Chinese people would cheat more than Americans. But again, the Chinese showed the same levels of dishonesty. Francesca Gino from Italy was positive that Italians would cheat the most. "Come to Italy and we will show you what cheating is all about," she said in her fantastic accent. But she was proven wrong too. We discovered the same results in Turkey, Canada, and England. In fact, the amount of cheating seems to be equal in every country, at least in those we've tested so far. How can we reconcile the fact that our experiments don't show any real differences in dishonesty among various countries and cultures with the very strong personal conviction that people from different countries cheat to different degrees? And how can we reconcile the lack of differences we see in our results with the clear differences in corruption levels among countries, cultures, and continents? I think that both perspectives are correct, Our data reflect an important and real aspect of cheating, but so do cultural differences. Here's why. Our matrix test exists outside any cultural context. That is, it's not an ingrained part of any social or cultural environment. Therefore, it tests the basic human capacity to be morally flexible and reframe situations and actions in ways that reflect positively on ourselves. Our daily activities, on the other hand, are entwined in a complex cultural context. This cultural context can influence dishonesty in two main ways. It can take particular activities and transition them into and out of the moral domain, and it can change the magnitude of the fudge factor that is considered acceptable for any particular domain. Take plagiarism, for example. At American universities, plagiarism is taken very seriously. But in other cultures, it is viewed as a kind of poker game between the students and faculty. In those cultures, getting caught, rather than the action of cheating itself, is viewed negatively. Similarly, in some societies, different kinds of cheating, not paying taxes, having an affair, downloading software illegally, and running red lights when there is no traffic around, are frowned upon, while in other societies the same activities are viewed as neutral, or even confer bragging rights. Of course, there's a great deal more to learn about the influence of culture on cheating, both in terms of the societal influences that help curb dishonesty, and in terms of the social forces that make dishonesty and corruption more likely.
In his books, Sowell mentions the famous New York City parking ticket study done in 2006 by Ray Fissman and Edward Miguel. This study compared how diplomats from various countries around the world ranked in terms of illegal parking and the paying of their tickets. In this clip, Dan Ariely speaks with Ray Fissman about this study, and he tells us about another similar study done in Europe. Fascinating stuff.
In this program, Dan talks with Ray Fissman of Columbia University about the link between corrupt countries and dishonest behavior.
So you did one of my favorite data analysis on parking in New York City. So first of all, I want to know what kind of gave you the idea and what did you find?
The idea actually came from a BBC article, which Ted Miguel, my co-author, saw on the wanton parking habits of Nigerian diplomats. And he sent me an email with a link to the article and essentially saying, wow, this is a cool idea. We should look at this more generally and see if people who come from countries that are associated with high corruption act on these values in a sense in their legal compliance when there's really no individual incentive to do so, only constrained by conscience, to see if people act out on the values that are associated with their home countries. What we did, we then contacted the traffic people in the Bloomberg administration, and they sent us a CD with every diplomatic parking violation over some stretch of years. And the basic finding is that diplomats' home country corruption is an extraordinarily good predictor of how often they double park and park in front of fire hydrants when allowed to do so, courtesy of diplomatic immunity in Manhattan.
So what does this tell you? It tells you that corruption practices in their own country kind of mitigate into other types of behaviors even when they move to a new environment?
The title of the paper is Cultures of Corruption, Evidence from Diplomatic Parking Violations. And it's to get at this idea that while culture is a somewhat incendiary term, to blame things on culture, if you think about culture as just what you are become accustomed to through a lifetime for whatever reason, that goes with you wherever you go. That is, I take my norms of flouting the law. If I've been brought up in a place where people flout the law, I take it to New York City, and where I'm able to then flout the law without consequence, I do so. As opposed to the Swedes, for example, who grow up in a high legal compliance society, and when they move to Manhattan and have the opportunity to break the law with no legal consequences, they don't.
So do you think it has to do with the fact that people with high corruption society, probably corruption often involves the police? So what I'm thinking about is whether corruption is domain specific. So for example, in countries where people have high corruption on monetary policies or in places where there's high corruption in building permits, would those all things look the same? Or is it the fact that you've captured something that is basically about corruption with the police force And that's the thing that has been carried around. Do you think it's domain specific or not?
So I think a big part of it, a big part of what governs behavior is what I think everyone else is doing or will do. And so if I grow up with people not obeying the police and I have the opportunity to not obey the police and not suffer the consequences, I will do so. If I grow up around people paying off building inspectors and getting away with it, I don't suffer any psychic inner sanction for doing so. So it's not immediately obvious to me that it should be domain specific. I'm going to also give you just some very tentative results, or I actually shouldn't describe them as tentative, some results from a study that I'm just wrapping up, just posted on my website, on the behavior of European parliamentarians, which some corner of these results closely parallel the parking violation stuff. So European parliamentarians get paid a stipend of around 300 euros for each day they show up to work, sign the register. Now, there was a scandal a few years ago captured on film by an Austrian member of the European Parliament of parliamentarians literally leaving their cars idling outside, running in, signing the register, and then running out and driving off.
How often?
Some might call it corruption, but it doesn't involve the police.
Yes.
So this is similarly – this sort of what I would call dishonest behavior, shirking, yep, is similarly correlated with home country corruption. You get a lot of this from Italian and Greek MEPs, not so much from the Swedes.
Well, the Greeks. What should we say about the Greeks?
Or the Israelis or Canadians, for that matter.
Oh, you're putting the Israelis and Canadians in the same boat? That's good.
Well, I'm putting you and me in the same boat.
Thank you very much.
There's a recent story from Japan which highlights the differences in expected levels of honesty between cultures. This is the headline from the New York Post about what happened.
Japanese school principal fired, loses $133,000 pension after getting caught stealing less than 50 cents worth of coffee.
The article continues.
A principal in Japan has been fired after allegedly being caught underpaying for his coffee multiple times. As a result, he will not receive his retirement pay valued at about 20 million yen. The incident was reported in January in the city of Takasago, located in Hyogo Prefecture, Honshu, by local Japanese media. The 59-year-old male principal of a Takasago junior high school was reportedly busted after using a self-service coffee machine at a convenience store. He allegedly had been pouring himself a large-size coffee while only paying for a regular-size coffee. He was reportedly fired on January 30th, with the board citing gross misconduct unbecoming of an educational public servant. The board members stated they were sorry from the bottom of their hearts for allowing it to happen.
Can you even imagine this happening here in the United States? And while we're talking about honesty in Japan, I came across this orchestral version of Billy Joel's song Honesty, played by none other than the Japanese Army Band. If only our school principal from Takasago had listened to this song before he went for his morning cup of coffee. Another key point Ariely makes in his book is that dishonesty is contagious and that it spreads within a society from person to person. He says this.
The idea that dishonesty can be transmitted from person to person via social contagion suggests that we need to take a different approach to curbing dishonesty. In general, we tend to view minor infractions as just that, trivial and inconsequential. Peccadilloes may be relatively insignificant in and of themselves, but when they accumulate within a person, across many people, and in groups, they can send a signal that it's all right to misbehave on a larger scale. From this perspective, it's important to realize that the effects of individual transgressions can go beyond a singular dishonest act. Passed from person to person, dishonesty has a slow, creeping, socially erosive effect. As the virus mutates and spreads from one person to another, a new, less ethical code of conduct develops. And although it is subtle and gradual, the final outcome can be disastrous. This is the real cost of even minor instances of cheating, and the reason we need to be more vigilant in our efforts to curb even small infractions.
I personally believe that dishonesty is highly contagious, because I believe that game theory explains much of human behavior. According to game theory, we take into account how we think other people are behaving or will behave in deciding how we ourselves will behave. So if we think most other people will be dishonest in seeking advantages in life, then we ourselves are more likely to behave dishonestly in seeking our own benefits. We don't want to get left behind in the game of life by clinging to our honesty virtues. So if dishonesty is contagious, what can a society do to impede the formation and spread of dishonest behavior? Thus was born the theory of broken windows policing, Ariely explains.
Kelling and Wilson proposed a critical component of keeping order in dangerous neighborhoods, and it wasn't just putting more police on the beat. They argued that if people in a rundown area of town see a building with a few broken, long unrepaired windows, they will be tempted to break even more windows and create further damage to the building and its surroundings, creating a blight effect. Based on the broken windows theory, they suggested a simple strategy for preventing vandalism. Fix problems when they are small. If you repair each broken window or other misbehaviors immediately, other potential offenders are going to be much less likely to misbehave. Although the broken windows theory has been difficult to prove or refute, its logic is compelling. It suggests that we should not excuse, overlook, or forgive small crimes because doing so can make matters worse. This is especially important for those in the spotlight: politicians, public servants, celebrities, and CEOs. It might seem unfair to hold them to higher standards, but if we take seriously the idea that publicly observed behavior has a broader impact on those viewing the behavior, this means that their misbehavior can have greater downstream consequences for society at large. In contrast to this view, it seems that celebrities are too often rewarded with lighter punishments for their crimes than the rest of the population, which might suggest to the public that these crimes and misdemeanors are not all that bad.
Before I bring Dan Ariely onto the podcast, I'd like to share with you one of the funniest songs ever written on the subject of honesty and how we rationalize our dishonest behavior. Probably most of you will have never heard of this song. It is kind of obscure. I'm going to play the whole song just because it's that good, and the whole story told in the song has to be heard to be fully appreciated. Listen carefully to the lyrics. I think you're going to love it. It's not a Billy Joel song. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny Cash singing his 1976 classic, One Piece at a Time.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, 'cause I always wanted me one that was long and black. One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man. I'd sneak it out of there in a lunchbox in my hand. Now getting caught meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the time I retired. I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000. I'd get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime. You'll know it's me when I come through your town. I'm gonna ride around in style, I'm gonna drive everybody wild, 'cause I'll have the only one there is around. So the very next day when I punched in with my big lunchbox and with help from my friend, I left that day with a lunchbox full of gear. I've never considered myself a thief, but GM wouldn't miss just one little piece, especially if I strung it out over several years. The first day I got me a fuel pump, and the next day I got me an engine and a trunk. Then I got me a transmission and all the chrome. The little things I could get in my big lunchbox, like nuts and bolts and all four shocks, but the big stuff we snuck out my buddy's mobile home. Now up to now my plan went all right, till we tried to put it all together one night, and that's when we noticed that something was definitely wrong. The transmission was a 53 and the motor turned out to be a 73, and when we tried to put in the bolts all the holes were gone. So we drilled it out so that it would fit, and with a little bit of help from an adapter kit, we had that engine running just like a song. Now the headlights, there was another sight. We had two on the left and one on the right, but when we pulled out the switch, all three of them come on. The back end looked kind of funny too, but we put it together, and when we got through, well, that's when we noticed that we only had one tail fin. About that time, my wife walked out, and I could see in her eyes that she had her doubts. But she opened the door and said, "Honey, take me for a spin." So we drove uptown just to get the tags, and I headed to ride on down Main Drag. I could hear everybody laughing for blocks around. But up there at the courthouse, they didn't laugh, cause to type it up, it took the whole staff. And when they got through, the title weighed 60 pounds. I got it one piece at a time, and it didn't cost me a dime. You'll know it's me when I come through your town. I'm gonna ride around in style, I'm gonna drive everybody wild, cause I'll have the only one there is around. Yeah, Red Rider, this is the Cottonmouth in the Psycho Billy Cadillac, come on. Haul. This is the Cottonmouth, and negatory on the cost of this machine there, Red Rider. You might say I went right up to the factory and picked it up. It's cheaper that way. What model is it? Well, it's a 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59 automobile. It's a 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 65.
I understand this song as a metaphor for society and how we can lose trust within our society slowly and gradually over many years, one piece at a time. All the while, rationalizing how the missing pieces of our integrity won't be noticed or missed. With the profound wisdom and playful lyrics of One Piece at a Time floating around in your head, now is the perfect time to welcome today's guest, Dan Ariely. Welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Wow, what a lovely name for a podcast.
I asked you on the show because I was preparing an episode on the subject of honesty. And when you look for books on this topic, your book stands out as one of the best. In fact, one of the only, actually. There are not many books on the subject I could find on Amazon or in the library. I remember reading your book when it came out in 2012, and I reread it recently in preparation for this interview. You wrote the book 14 years ago, and I'm wondering how you talk about the book now, and if you would do anything differently if you were writing the book again.
First of all, my most recent book, which came out a few months ago, is called Misbelief. And, you know, it's about people who adopt a false narrative. So it's a different topic. It's a very different topic because the honest truth about dishonesty is really about the psychology of somebody who is committing a dishonest act. It's about what pushes us back, what pushes us forward, what are the motives. And when I wrote this book, it was after things like Enron and some other scandals, and I was wondering how do eventually good people, I did not believe that there were so many bad people. And I wondered whether it's possible that good people also make mistakes. And of course, the answer is yes. The last book is about misinformation and how good people get sucked into believing kind of a false narrative. Now, very different books. But if you ask me what is the challenge of our time, I'm kind of an applied social scientist. So there's lots of things to look at. There's lots of problems to solve. But I try to figure out what are the biggest problems that are facing us right now And that kind of directs my attention. So I think about what are big problems facing society and what I think that social science and I could have something to say about it. So if I wrote it now, I would write something closer to misbelief. I would basically ask less the questions about dishonesty. I would ask more the questions of adopting a false narrative. And I'll tell you why. If you looked at the world 10 years ago, and you asked the question, what are the big challenges facing humanity? I think disinformation would have not been one of them. If you look at society now and you say, what are the big problems that are facing us? I think disinformation would be one of them, because it's the thing that separates us. If you think about the US, we're not one country anymore. We're at least two countries that cannot agree on almost anything, that have very strong position to the other side. And it slows us from having trust, which is incredibly important, and it slows us from being able to move forward. And any other topic you bring in is going to be hampered by this question of disinformation, misbelief, lack of trust. So if I wrote, I know it's a long answer, but if I wrote the book today, I would say, what are the big problems facing us now? I think this would be it. That book is still important. And I think it's still an important question to understand. You know, when we talk about regulation and dishonesty and so on, still also very relevant to the current political situation, but not as crucial as this idea of misbelief.
In every heart, there is a room, a sanctuary safe and strong, to heal the wounds from lovers past, until a new one comes along. I spoke to you in cautious tone, you answered me with no pretense, and still I feel I've said too much. My silence is my self-defense. And every time I've...
Now, I haven't read Misbelief yet, but I'm definitely going to read it after we speak. And I really regret that I haven't read it before, because I feel like you kind of want to merge the two topics. Yeah. And I'm not really in a position to ask you any good questions about it.
I'm happy to join another time and continue the discussion.
Okay. I definitely want to read it. I first found your work back in 2008 with Predictably Irrational. And I loved the book. I was just talking about it. And it really launched my interest in behavioral economics. And then I read everything published on that subject that was popular, you know, the Kahneman and Tversky and the Nudge books. And, you know, I was just like all in on that. You know, it was a great, you know, new venue for me to explore. And I still love it. I still love it. Now, in his 2000 book, Basic Economics, and again, in his recent book, Social Justice Fallacies, and I sent you excerpts from those books.
Yeah.
Thomas Sowell talks about honesty and trust being crucial elements in the economic and social development of peoples. He described the wallet test and the parking ticket test as evidence that people from different cultures have very different standards for honesty and trust. Tell us about those tests and others like it, if you will, and what you have learned from studying them.
Yeah, so the parking ticket study basically look at diplomats. In New York City. And these are diplomats at the UN. And diplomats have immunity. So in principle, they can park anywhere they want. They're not fearing fine. It's only their ethical moral that is holding them back. So it's a beautiful question, right? Where you basically say, okay, you and I, regular mortals, when we do bad things in traffic, we can get a fine. So what's holding us back is both define in principle and our moral issues. But if you're a diplomat, it's only moral issues. And what they show in that test is that people basically are very, very different. You look at the Middle Eastern countries and they behave very differently from the Northern European countries. And, you know, there's been lots of arguments about the importance of abidance by law and trust to the GDP. And this is also, by the way, very important for misbelief, if you think about trust. Imagine a society that we trust each other. We can do lots of things. We can do a handshake. You can promise something. When something doesn't work out, we work on that. I'll actually tell you a story. I talked to this woman who started a company many, many years ago. And she started a company and she had lots of handshake agreements with lots of suppliers. And she told me that as she moved forward, she got lawyers. And every contract was negotiated very deeply with lawyers. And she said that in some of those discussions, the lawyers talk about all kinds of things that are offensive. Like, imagine you're my supplier, and imagine it's a cosmetics. And I say, what if your product ends up being including poison and my customers are going to sue me? How are you going to indemnify me for that? To a lawyer, it looks like an item on the list, but to a manufacturer, it looks like an accusation. What do you think? I'm going to poison? Like, where's the trust? And what she said is that, and she's right, is that you can never write a complete contract. Like, a contract that is a handshake is basically trust, like a marriage. You know, we'll work it out. We don't know what will happen. There'll be ups and downs. Things will happen. But, you know, I'm committed to you and you're committed to me that we will work it out. The moment you have a contract, first of all, you accuse the other person about all kinds of bad intentions. I want to protect myself. If you misrepresent yourself and if you poison my clients and if you give me bad things and so on. But also a contract will never cover everything. And what happens when something happens that are not covered? And what she told me is that sometimes things will happen. Like they need a bit less, they need a bit more. You know, all kinds of things change that are not exactly in the contract. And guess what? No goodwill. You know, and we have this model of, in evolutionary terms, we're not with contract. Our models is about the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law. Right? Think about you and I have these contracts, not written contracts about this podcast. There's lots of rules to it, but they're not written. But you and I understand. And when something happens, we will adjust because we are adhering to the spirit of the law, not the letter of the law. We're basically saying we're going to have an interesting discussions and hear the things and so on. By the way, you know, when Trump got elected, it was very clear how much democracy has rules that are not written. I'm not talking about the question of whether he broke real rules or not. That will happen. We'll see in court. But there were lots of unwritten rules about how you run democracy. And basically, he doesn't obey by these unwritten rules, and all kinds of things break because of this. So I would say that trust and what we call incomplete contract and understanding that it's about the spirit of the law and not the letter of the law are crucial things for society to move forward. We can see it very much in small scale, like marriages, but they're also very, very important for societies. And sadly, I think that lots of things are hurting them, including bureaucracy and legal and putting anything in the legalistic terms.
It's 9 o'clock on a Saturday. A regular crowd shuffles in. There's an old man sitting next to me, making love to his tonic and gin. Not really sure how it goes, but it's sad and it's sweet, and I knew it complete when I wore a younger man's clothes. La 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 la. Sing us a song, you're the piano man. Sing us a song tonight. Well, we're all in the mood for a melody, and you've got us feeling all right.
You know, it's funny you mention the contracts, because when I first started my business, and for, you know, I've been in business for 30 years, you know, outside of the podcasting, and I used to have, with every contract I sent out, I had a 5-page terms and conditions in very small print. And that developed over the years. Anytime something went wrong, I would add that to it, and I would add that to it, and I would add that to it. And I found that, of course, it protected me to a certain extent. But at a certain point in my career, I just said, you know what? I'm getting rid of the terms and conditions. I'm having no terms and conditions. It's just a one-page simple contract. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's what you're going to pay me. And we'll work it out if something goes wrong. And you know what? I have been so much happier since then. And the truth is that I have the best relationship with my clients. Almost nothing ever goes wrong. And when it does, I just fix it and everybody's happy. And, you know, that overly legalistic approach to life is something you do when you're, you know, trying to protect yourself against every possible eventuality.
That's right. So I'll tell you my story on this is that I had a handshake agreement with a friend, with somebody I met through friends. And this was to create some videos for a website. And I created videos. She wanted them shorter. I can't do anything. By now you're realizing I can't answer shortly. It's like not me. But anyway, she wanted short videos. So I recorded some videos of thoughts about life, like what's happening when we stand in line and wait for the suitcase and all kinds of things. She told me they were too long, so I tried to record shorter things. She told me they were not jazzy enough, so she got an editor to add all kinds of, you know, special effects and icons and stuff like that. We got the results. I didn't like it. It wasn't me. It was too short, not detailed enough, too much pizzazz. So I said, no, I can't do this. And she told me she already paid lots of money. She had a contract. She had to reverse it. She paid the editor and so on. And she asked me to pay for the contract and to pay her for her time. Like she had loss of, like she was hoping this would happen. So I decided to do it. She was a single mother. I decided it was not exactly fair, but I said, okay. But then I learned that all of this was not true. Yeah, she paid the editor 20% from what she said. She didn't have to pay for canceling the contract. And I confronted her on it. And of course, you know, she defended herself and said all kinds of irrelevant things. And when that happened, my instinct, well, I was so hurt. I was hurt by the lying and the, you know, she didn't pay me back. But you know, I was hurt by the lying and then the financial loss. And my first thought was, from now on, I'll always want contracts. But then I started thinking about, you know, this is about a strategy for life. Like, I didn't know that she would do this. Now, I would say, okay, what's my strategy for life? Look at all the things I do across all the things. I get lots of benefits from trust. You know, in my startups, for example, I basically tell all my partners, I trust you completely. The things that you need me that are connected to social science, please ask me. But the things that are not, don't involve me. Right? You have my full trust. Yeah, salary, whatever you want. Also, the people who work for me at this the research center. I'm here at Duke at the Center for Advanced Hindsight. We have quite a few people working with me in this research center. My management style is I tell them I'm at your disposal. And you don't need to report. I don't need additional red tape. You don't need to this. I trust you fully. Of course, when you need me, I'm here at your disposal. Kind of, you know, officially I'm their boss, but unofficially, like the way I feel, I'm at their service. I'm here to empower you. I'm here to let you flourish. I want you to follow your passion. Ask me anything you want, but I don't need to add bureaucracy and time and reporting to your life. So this strategy has a lot of benefits, but they're not as visible. Lots of things just run smoother. So it's great, but you don't notice it. When do you notice it? When something fails. And when something fails, the temptation is, I never want to experience it again. Let me cancel everything. Let me also eliminate all the benefits I'm getting from trust because I never want to feel hurt like this again. And it's very tough. But when I started thinking about all the benefits I'm getting from trust, I said, okay, I'm not changing my strategy. It was a painful experience. I'm sure I'll have more of those. And I think we need to understand that it's just part of the cost of doing business, is that if we choose a strategy for life of more trust, there's lots of benefits, and from time to time, there will be a cost. And the cost is more salient. The benefits are not as salient, and we have to remind ourselves about all the benefits we're getting.
Thomas Sowell talks about the difference.
Actually, can I cut you for another second?
Yeah, sure.
Think about these two models for luck. Okay, so, you know, whatever we got in life, some of it is skill and some of it is luck. And there are two models for luck. There's one kind of luck that says you win the lottery. Something big happens. You go to a party, you meet somebody, they give you a job. you know, it's like really lucky events. And we all had those things. Oh, my goodness, there's like one step that is incredibly important. And there's the other things about luck, which are small things that happen that we don't notice. You get one step here and you go to this place and you meet this person and you go to a slightly different person and you meet this other person and you work in a slightly different project and that opens the door and opens the window and opens the crack. And we're good at understanding our own and pretending that everything we got is our own skill. We're also good at noticing big luck. Little luck we don't notice as much. And I think trust is a good analogy for this, is that sometimes we trust something and big things happen, but mostly trust is about the little things and we end up not noticing.
No, it's very true. And I've been thinking a lot about trust lately. I moved to Los Angeles in 2009. And when I first came to LA, in my neighborhood, almost nobody had a gate right at the street. When I first lived in my house, anybody could walk up to my front door and knock on it and try to sell me something or whatever. Then I noticed everybody started putting gates up with a lock so that you could not get to the front door of the house without, you know, opening the gate. And that to me was a very, you know, symbolic of the lack of trust in the culture. 40 years ago in this neighborhood, there were no gates.
Yeah.
Now, almost everybody has a gate.
And probably not just a gate, but also a fence.
Yeah, a gate and a fence and cameras.
Yeah. You know, there's a real interesting effect in architecture about houses with front yards and backyard. And it turns out that front yards create a much more social environment. Why? Because you walk on the pavement, maybe not a lot, maybe just a little bit, but you walk on the pavement. And if you have front yards, people are in the front yard. There's a chance you'll say hi. They'll say hi. Maybe they'll invite you in for a drink. You know, things happen. Backyards end up being not a catalyst for change because you don't know that other people are in their backyards. So the social environment of a neighborhood changes dramatically. And then if you have front yards or a front porch and you put a gate and a fence, it's over. It's over. But we're inherently social creatures. You know, there's all kinds of things that we're doing in the last X years to reduce our resilience. Trust is one of them. But another one is that our social fabric is dramatically limited. And we get a lot of our resilience from that. And once, you know, we don't know our neighbors, we have nobody to turn to, we feel more alone, nobody to share our challenges. Economic inequality is contributing to that. Lots of bad things happen. So, but anyway, we've been on a tangent, but if we go on the original question, so the answer is yes. Trust is a huge component in GDP. I mean, it has the element, the social element, but also in GDP, right? Because what we said, we can write flexible contracts. We trust in each other. We inherently care about the benefit of the other person. We think more long term. If I do a handshake agreement with you, we basically need to be nicer to each other, and we're also thinking more long term. And if something goes wrong and you do something for me, now I say, okay, you know, I owe you something, and I can trust you even further. So the next time, I'm more likely to do something with you. And once these things are done, very, very hard to do lots of things.
She can kill with a smile, she can wound with her eyes, and she can ruin your faith with her casual lies. And she only reveals what she wants you to see. She hides like a child, but she's always a woman to me. She can lead you to love, she can take you or leave you. She can ask for the truth, but she'll never believe. And she'll take what you give her as long as it's free. Yeah, she steals like a thief, but she's always a woman to me.
Talk to us about the difference between different countries a little bit. So Will makes a big point on this. And one of the things he says is that people who live in countries where there's not a lot of trust in the legal system have to depend on the family unit to do business. Yeah. They can't, because they can't trust strangers, because they know the legal system doesn't have their back. And, you know,
I'll give you an example of this. I have an Iranian friend, and he told me that in his youth they had a family business, and they had to hire a lot of incompetent people that were family. Now, they didn't have to because they had to, but because trust was more important than competence, right? So imagine a world in which you don't trust other people, betraying you is very easy. Who would you hire? Would you hire somebody competent, or would you hire somebody that you can trust? I see this in some of more of the third world countries in terms of education. Imagine you're a head of a village and you need a school teacher. Who are you going to hire? You know, you're going to hire somebody good, or you're going to hire somebody you trust. So, you know, when there's a trust gap, trust is so important. We don't necessarily fill it in the right way. Now, let me say something about cultural differences. As you know, we've been doing lots of this research on dishonesty, and basically the finding in very quickly is that people can rationalize dishonest acts. So it means that people want to be honest in general, but they also want to benefit from dishonesty. Imagine I go to a restaurant and there's these amazing caviar or cookies or whatever, and they say, please take one per customer. And nobody's looking, and I feel like taking more. Right? Like, how do we weigh? Like, oh, I feel a little bit better if I took a bit more, but it's not nice, and so on. And what we find in general is that people cheat a little bit. People cheat up to the degree that they will still feel comfortable with it. So nobody would come and take all the cookies and go home. But people say, oh, you know what? I'm bringing one to my significant other, or yesterday they were finished, I'll take two now. Like people justify it. The basic idea is that people cheat a little bit to the extent that they feel good about this. So I'll give you one example and then I'll answer your question. So I owned a vending machine and for experiments. And in this particular experiment, I wrote on the vending machine 75 cents for candy, but I programmed the machine to be at the cost of zero. So people put the money, they pressed the button for the candy, but they got all their money back because everything was more than zero, but they were surprised. So they thought the machine was broken. And the question, there were two questions. One is, how many candies would people take? You just learned that this machine gives candy for free. Would you try it again and for how long? And then I had a sign that says, if the machine is broken, please call this number. It was my phone number so I could see how many people call. So nobody called. And most people took three or four candies, nobody took five, right? And the idea is that people could justify taking a few. People could say something like, oh, I remember another candy machine that took my money and didn't give me a candy, or the candy was old, and this candy machine is a close relative of the other one, and I'm just balancing my candy karma. Yeah, so it's all about justification. Now, we've run experiments like this, not like the candy machine, but in the same spirit, when people could report that they deserve more money than they do in many countries. And in our experiment, we did not find any cultural difference, right? So we tried the US and Canada and England and Israel, and we tried Turkey, and we tried Japan, and we tried Sweden, and we tried Kenya, and we tried South Africa, and we tried lots of countries. And we don't really find a difference. Now, how can that be? For one, the corruption index is very, very different among countries. You know, we picked Kenya as one of the leading countries in the world in terms of corruption. How come there was no difference? And the finding was that our task, these people did a test and they could overclaim money, was new to people. It was not in a cultural domain. It was basically testing people's willingness to cheat a little bit and still feel good about themselves, how much they could cheat. And in that regard, people are quite similar the world over. But within different domains, people do adopt different ethics. And these domains do not bleed into each other. Right? So for example, if you go to a country that is very corrupt, like Kenya, it doesn't mean that if you play basketball with people, they will cheat you. Or it doesn't mean that, you know, people would necessarily steal from stores. Right? What happened is that life is like silos. Right? In which silos are we willing as a society to tolerate things that are illegal? For example, downloading illegal software, right, or illegal music. Now it's it's so available. But it used to be that people would download lots of illegal movies and music and so on and didn't feel bad about it, right? It's not as if you would take college students and you say, hey, do you download illegal music? And they said yes. And I say, how bad do you feel about it? They say, oh, don't feel bad at all. Now, it says in the name, downloading illegal music. Why don't people care? Because as society, we said, this is not an activity we care about. So think about, like, there's a backbone of human honesty, and we're very similar generally on that. But then there are silos in which we say, this domain, I don't care so much. And this domain, I care a lot about. And of course, as we deteriorate in a single domain, that gets worse and worse because it becomes socially acceptable. So, you know, if, for example, people are willing to not declare all their taxes, and we know that other people are doing it, then it's easier for us to justify it. We say, you know, how bad do I feel? Not so bad. Other people are doing it as well. So think about this as these silos. Online dating, by the way, people are willing to cheat a lot in that, right? People are willing to slightly younger age, slightly fewer pounds, slightly taller, all kinds of things like that. And people don't feel bad when they do it. They basically say, well, that's the game. That's what everybody does. They, you know, the pictures are slightly with a filter and so on. I would not say that somebody who is exaggerating on their online profile for a dating site will necessarily steal money from a petty cash box in the office. These are kind of separate, very, very separate domains. But what's happened to us, for example, in social media is that all of a sudden honesty on social media is not an issue. And because it's not an issue, and we know that it's not an issue for other people, it's becoming tougher and tougher.
Good night, my angel, time to close your eyes and save these questions for another day. I think I know what you've been asking me. I think you know what I've been trying to say. I promised I would never leave you, and you should always know, wherever you may go, no matter where you are, I never will be far.
One of the key findings of your book is that cheating and dishonesty has a contagious nature.
Yes.
Now, you don't use the term game theory in your book, but I've always felt that game theory explains a lot about human behavior. For example, if someone believes that everyone is lying on dating sites, then he too will be more likely to exaggerate his height or his weight because he would feel like a schmuck for being the only one telling the truth. Yes. And he would also know that he would have a competitive disadvantage if he told the truth because everybody else is lying.
That's right. So in standard game theory, it's all about rational. Right. So in your description, if everybody is doing this, I need to do that as well. That's very much part of game theory. The schmuck part is not, because the schmuck part is the feeling that I will have. So that's not part of game theory. Game theory is about coordinated effort between rational agents. So a lot of it is like that, but the emotional component is not part of that. But basically saying, if everybody is doing it, I need to do it as well. That's yes. But the other thing is, if everybody is doing it, I would not feel bad doing it. That's not part of game theory. Because game theory has no room for feeling. It has lots of other things.
A bottle of white, a bottle of red, perhaps a bottle of rosé instead. Get a table near the street, in our old familiar place, you and I, face to face. A bottle of red, a bottle of white, it all depends upon your appetite. I'll meet you anytime you want in our Italian.
In your book, you mentioned the Princeton Honor Code and how seriously that school takes the idea of honesty and integrity, and how they even have a song about it, which every freshman is forced to hear. I actually corresponded with the gentleman who wrote that song, and I'll be playing that song for fun in this podcast.
Oh, that's lovely. Can't wait to hear it.
What are your thoughts about the plagiarism scandals which have been rocking academia over the past few months? We have the Claudine Gay scandal, where she was forced to step down as the president of Harvard over credible accusations of plagiarism, but she was still able to keep her very lucrative teaching position. And now it's coming out that other people at Harvard and other prestigious universities have plagiarized in their academic work. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so maybe let me separate the Harvard fiasco from other things. So I'm Jewish, I'm Israeli. I've spent most of the time since October 7th in Israel. Lots of sadness everywhere. I have been very upset with what's happening in American universities. Harvard and MIT are probably the worst examples. And I was at MIT for 10 years, so that pains me personally much more. I would have wanted those institutions to take a leadership role in making the world a better place. If you ask the question of what is the role of a university, the role of a university has to be to make the world better. Like, what are we doing? What are we really supposed to be doing? We're an NGOs, we're non-for-profits, we don't pay taxes. We're supposed to work for the public benefit. What's the public benefit that we're working for? It's not just education for education's sake. It needs to have some kind of good outcome for people and for the world. So what should the university done after October 7th? I think a place like Harvard, what they should have done is they say, we're lucky enough to have Israeli students, Palestinian students, Jewish students, Muslim students. Let's take all of those. Let's sit together. Let's not blame each other, because that doesn't help do anything. Let's figure out a couple of solutions. What is our role in improving the world? What are we going to come up with out of the box? Young, smart, thoughtful, energetic people. That's the engine of universities plus professors. Let's do something for good. And instead, they just gave us a model for more fighting. And like, you know, if students cannot hold themselves from being vile and abusive to each other 3,000 miles away from Gaza, what hope do we have? So I think this was a tremendous failure of leadership. In many ways, I think that MIT is worse. If you look, I don't know, I mean, Claudine Gay they're a bit more visible, Harvard and MIT, but MIT is awful as well. Penn also, lots of people have made mistakes. By the way, I was not happy that there were calls to fire her after this hearing, because, you know, if we go back to the question of trust and so on, I think it's okay to make a mistake. You know, if I was under investigation in front of Congress, I probably would have made a few mistakes too, right? It's stressful, it's pressure, the advice from lawyers, I don't know what to do. But I would have hoped that after this fiasco, all presidents of university would have said, let's take leadership. Let's try something new. Maybe it will fail. Maybe it would not work. Maybe we'll give everybody 2 weeks to work out a couple of solutions, and eventually students would hate each other even more. But this atmosphere that we have now is atmosphere of fear. Like, I think that almost all universities are just putting their heads down and say, I just don't want to do anything. I don't want to try anything. I don't want to participate. I don't want anybody to cover me. I don't want any student to complain. Let's just take zero risk. Of course, zero risk comes with zero reward. So I think universities are basically going to learn from all of this, not to contribute. They're going to learn to avoid conflict and therefore not live up to their potential. I would have loved to see the president of Harvard coming back from this and say, you know what? Let's try something. Might fail. It might not work out, but let's see what we can do. Anyway, so that's one big component. In terms of plagiarism, I think that for a crime to be committed, you need intention. If I quote Winston Churchill, Winston Churchill's heart is, but let's say I quote none of his, like, something not very common, but I write something about it. And I intend to, but I forget to cite it, put the footnote down. Is it really that terrible? It's very sad. It's a mistake. If I take somebody's thank you to their dissertation advisor because I like it so much how they wrote it, and I change it a little bit, but not enough for the algorithm, and I don't cite it. I think people take pieces from all kinds of places. Of course, we have the ideal behavior of what we would want. We have to acknowledge that people make mistakes from time to time. And this idea of everything is black or gray or black or white is just not right. Let me ask you, on the average page that you type, how many typos do you make?
A lot.
Yeah.
There are a lot of words I don't really know how to spell that well, actually.
You know, when you drive for an hour, how many mistakes do you make that don't end up in an accident just because there were no cars in the next lane? Or like, yeah, a lot. We, you know, this idea of people being mistake-free is kind of crazy. And I think we need to recognize mistakes. Like, you know, let's take these cases. By the way, there are some cases that are very clear, right? If you lift a paper from a student, like, you know, there were cases of professors who took a paper from their students, no question. But if somebody copies something and like I had a friend who wrote something and he wrote the text and he put like three letters to say to find the reference later or the quote later. And in the editing process, his editor took some of these three letters out. And he marked for himself that he was going to quote it, and he later forgot, and people got very upset. So I think intention is very important. When people don't have intention, I think it changes, right? It changes in murder. Like if you know, intention and not intention matters a lot. And I also think that we need a different model for people making mistakes. Like if you think about when people make mistake, every time they make a mistake, we would just go down on them with every intensity. People are just going to stop doing anything. Like the easiest thing to do is to say, like what I think universities are going to do now. I think universities, after this catastrophe, I think universities are going to be places that do less. They will try not to upset the students and not to upset the Congress and not to upset the parents. And the easiest way to do it is not to do anything. So let's not teach, and let's not provoke, and let's not challenge the students. Let's just do nothing. And it's a bad strategy. It's a bad strategy. I think, you know, we mentioned earlier that life is about a portfolio. And if you think about life as a portfolio, you have to think about what is your risk portfolio. So imagine I told you, I said, Alan, you're going to go and have 100 meals now with people that you don't know. How many of those meals do you want to push the envelope? Do you want to challenge people with their opinions about Gaza? With their opinions about minorities in the States? How many of those meals would you like to challenge people about poverty, gender inequality? You know, how many of them do you want to challenge about the existence of God? And, you know, so on. If you thought about each one of them, like, you know, an hour before each of those meals, I would say, how much do you want to take a risk upsetting your hosts and talking about potentially taboo topics? You will say, oh, not tonight. I really don't feel. So let's just talk about weather and sports. But if I say, from now until the end of your life, how much do you want to talk just about weather and sports? You would say, not so much. So I think we need to figure out a risk strategy and look and think about the upside and the downside and not just think about the downside. By the way, I'm not a good dinner host. I take risks.
I'm the same way as you. I would talk about these topics 100% of the time. The only thing that keeps me contained is my wife. And she'll say, tonight, don't mention X, don't mention Y, don't mention Z, because I want to have a nice evening.
Yeah. So I'm divorced.
And part of the reason I created the podcast was that I would have a place where I could talk about X, Y, and Z whenever I want. And if people don't want to tune in, they don't have to.
Yeah.
Now, in your book, you talk a lot about the devious practices of big pharma companies to manipulate doctors into prescribing their drugs and that, you know, that could be a whole book in and of itself.
Yep.
What else have you learned about this industry during the COVID wave?
Yeah.
Have things changed for the better or for the worse in that domain?
Yeah. So first of all, things have changed a lot for the better pre-COVID. I think pharma companies realized some of the things that they were doing, and many of them self-regulated even before COVID. So things have gotten much, much better. There was even one pharma company that was in touch with me, and they changed their reward to their salespeople from quantity of sales to how helpful they were to the physicians. So it was like a soft measure, not a hard measure, not units sold, but they were you helpful. I also want to say something good about pharma. We had this opioid epidemic, still terrible, terrible, awful. And people, there's some bad actors and some bad things have happened, but I have been a very heavy user of opioids. So I was in, as you know, I was in hospital for 3 years for severe burns, 70% of my body. And I got lots of opioids, a lot of morphine. In fact, not enough. In today's standard, I would have gotten much more. At that point, they were even more afraid about addiction than they are now. And I didn't get a lot. I didn't get enough. I was undertreated. But as somebody who had tremendous pain, and burns are unbelievably painful. Like the process of bandage removal is just, it's torture, right? Imagine no skin, the bandages adhere to the flesh, there's some bleeding, so it's extra tough. And then it needs to come off once a day, 70% of my body, very, very, very. And I cannot tell you how grateful I am for opioids. Life was very tough, in many cases not worth living, but without opioids, it would have been, I would have certainly not, I thought a lot about ending life, but without opioids, I would have never wanted to experience. There was no question. Like if you say, this experience in hospital, no opioids, do you want to live? No, I would say certainly not. No question, like not even close call. So in the discussion of opioids, I think that part is missing. It's not that it's not that I'm happy that people got addicted. I mean, this is all like it's all, but it's more complex than people make it to be. And there's so many benefits to it. There's so many people who owe their lives and their sanity and well-being to opioids. And we need to be more balanced. We need to understand it's a more complex argument than just. Bad pharma created opioids, people good, pharma bad, and so on. During COVID, like what I really wanted to do when COVID kind of was maybe a few months into it, I called a friend in the pharma industry and I said that let's do a movie on the scientists who are working in their labs. You know, this was a heroic effort. Here are people who basically thought, and you remember in the early days, there were lots of companies who were running to try and do vaccine. These were people who were working day and night and not seeing their family. This was like a heroic effort. Some companies made it, many failed. But even the ones who failed, they ran for a long time. They tried different things. It was, you know, at the end of the day, it was a story of human triumph. People worked unbelievably hard, thought very creatively, tried very different approaches. Many of them didn't work. But, you know, even if somebody like some scientist spent 100 hours a week in the lab for 3 months, hoping it would work out and they would be able to come up with something that would work, it's just amazing. So I think we missed an opportunity. I think we missed an opportunity not to tell the story of heroism of the scientists in these companies. And instead, it became a story of suspicion and not sufficient appreciation and so on. So I think, yes, pharma companies have very complex financial structure. They create lots of bad incentives. Some of them they are trying to get over. Some of them are tougher to get over. But I think COVID was just an amazing story of success, that's of like real human triumph, that I'm very sad that he's not been told in a deeper way.
In the beginning, there was the cold and the night. Prophets and angels gave us the fire and the light. Man was triumphant, armed with the faith and the will. But even the darkest ages couldn't kill. Too many kingdoms, too many flags on.
One of the things you talk about, another thing you talk about in your book, is the broken windows theory of policing and the downstream effects of small crimes snowballing into larger crimes. This is a big topic, I think, especially because law enforcement is a huge topic right now. And, you know, I told you, I mentioned before that I moved to LA in 2009. And within the first 2 months of living in LA, I was a real victim of broken windows policing. I got 2 tickets for not coming to a complete stop at a stop sign. I got a ticket for exiting the HOV lane early, you know, before the double yellow lines had stopped. That was a $380 ticket, by the way.
Wow.
I got a ticket for like one of those stoplight cameras, you know, like making a turn when I shouldn't have been, you know. And I even got a ticket. Listen to this one. 5 a.m, I'm crossing the street from my car to go to Starbucks to get a coffee. There was no car within a mile in either direction. And then a policeman on a motorcycle happens to be turning the corner at that very moment. He gives me a ticket for jaywalking. Okay. That was also a $300 ticket. I mean, this, to me, LA was the most law enforced place that I had ever lived in. Now, nothing. I've never seen a cop pull over anybody. I see people going through red lights. I mean, the most egregious behavior, the philosophy of law enforcement has completely changed in the, you know, 15 years that I've been in LA. And, broken windows, I mean, forget about broken windows. There is no broken windows policing going on in this country, as far as I can tell. What are your thoughts on that?
So first of all, I've been a lot in LA recently. I don't know if you know, but I helped write a TV show called The Irrational.
I didn't know that.
So there's a TV show on NBC called The Irrational, loosely based on my life. Jesse Martin is the professor. He teaches at a made-up university. His research center is called the Institute for Advanced Hindsight. Mine is called the Center for Advanced Hindsight. He got injured in the story in a different way, but he studied social science. He does research, and he helps the FBI solve crime. So that's the show. So I've been a lot in LA for this show, and yes, driving in LA is an adventure. I think they call it the California roll, right? That you just don't really stop. It's just a suggestion. But this idea of what is our boundaries is incredibly important. And if you think about the things that are successful, it's like being vegetarian or being vegan. They create very clear roles. If you say to yourself, I'll not eat meat 3 days a week, which days are those? And do you ever feel that you're not doing that? And then it's easy to slip. If you say, I'm vegetarian, you have rules. So if you look at religion doesn't say, try to be better. The religion says, do and don't do. Very, very clear demarcations. If you think about dieting, like if you say, okay, my rule for diet is I'm going to eat everything on the plate aside from 3 forkfuls, not going to happen. But if you say, let me cut soft drinks, much easier. Like everything that we do for our own decision, categorical, is much, much easier. Like if you think about the not stopping at stop sign, what exactly is it? It's like, is it 2 miles per hour? Is it 5? Is it 10? You know, where does it? It doesn't help you to see that. So there are lots of things where creating our own rules are important because it's easier to adhere, right? It's in some sense, it's easier to stop smoking than to go on a diet, stopping to smoke is like you go to zero. Diet, like there's no clear parameters. And then the other thing, of course, is the social norms. When we see things around us, we adhere to them. If other people are jaywalking, we jaywalk. If other people are doing the California roll, we do the California roll. If other people are cutting in line, we cut in line, and so on. So it's both about the personal rules, our personal rules of what we do and don't do, and also about what we see around us, which justifies lots of bad behavior. So both of those are important. And from that perspective, when you prevent somebody from jaywalking, you're not just preventing them from jaywalking. You're helping the people who would have seen them as well. We all are at the risk of creating either good or bad influence on the people around us. But by the way, you know, in Judaism, there's a belief that giving money to charity in private, in secrecy, is the right way to give. And of course, it's true, right? If you give and nobody knows about it, that kind of represents your true self. You're not doing it to be arrogant or to boast or something like that. On the other hand, giving money away without nobody seeing is not creating a social norm, right? So from that perspective, I think we should make charity more visible to other people, because we want people to know, because we want that behavior to become more common. But going back to your question, yes, it's very important. And if we talk about Hollywood, I think we have a tendency to be extra lenient with people who are famous, like celebrities. But in fact, we should be least lenient with celebrities. Why should we be least lenient? Because their activity is the most visible. So if there's a celebrity person that is driving drunk, let's say, you know, how many people after that will think that driving drunk is an okay thing to do if you say, okay, please say sorry and you don't have to have a fine? Like, it's not nice to say it, but it's not nice to say that we should be less lenient with people who are more well-known. But it is true from a social science perspective that the people who are more well-known have a bigger effect on people's perception on what's right and wrong.
Some people stay far away from the door if there's a chance of it opening up. They hear a voice in the hall outside and hope that it just passes by. Some people live with the fear of a touch and the anger of having been a fool. They will not listen to anyone, so nobody tells them a lie. I know you're only protecting yourself. I know you're thinking of somebody else. Someone who hurt you, but I'm not above making up for the love you've been denying you could ever feel.
We're at the end of our time, but I want to ask you one more question on this subject about shoplifting. Here in California, where I live, you're allowed to shoplift up to, I believe it's $950 at one time without it being considered, I don't know if it's a felony or a misdemeanor or any kind of crime at all. I'm not really sure. But this has led to a spate of shoplifting, you know, to the point where, like, when I go to my neighborhood Target, many things are behind locked cabinets, even things like laundry detergent, underwear, socks, where you have to call a salesperson to come and unlock the cabinet for you. So shoplifting has gotten out of hand. What are your thoughts? Let's end on that topic. You know, what are the prospects for a society where, you know, shoplifting is just the norm?
Yeah. So my guess, I don't know this law. You know, it was such a high amount. That's crazy. But my guess is that the law was designed for this because we don't want people to become felons. Like, we want to separate small and big transgression, and we don't want to take people who made a mistake. My guess is that they didn't want to take people who are in hard time, commit a crime, steal something, and then we destine them to a life of crime after that. So my guess is that was the spirit of the intention of the law. But this is a great example to think about erosion of trust, you know, and everybody pays the price. So if you basically say, you know, Target doesn't trust anybody who's coming in, everybody's paying the trust. Now the cost. Now it doesn't matter who you are, you know, we just pay the price. And that's a dramatically important issue. Think about this as a metaphor for bureaucracy. Some people are breaking the law. There's a new law, like lock everything. And now everybody paying the price. Some people cheat their insurance company. Now the insurance company is making the process so cumbersome that they want receipts and proofs and so on. And they go back and forth with you 10 times and they don't trust you. And it takes forever. We're ruining ourselves. So bad apples destroy things for everybody. By the way, in a very non-symmetrical way, right? Good apples don't have the same effect as bad apples. Bad apples have a very bad effect. And if we decide to deal something rather than deal with the bad apples, we apply a rule for everybody, everybody pays the price. So it's a very sad deterioration.
Professor Dan Ariely, thank you for joining me on the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Thank you so much. It was delightful.
This has been episode 39 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. If you like this podcast and want to support the work we are doing, introducing more and more people to the ideas of Thomas Sowell, there are many ways you can help. Rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends about Sowell and the podcast. Support us on Patreon. Purchase our Thomas Sowell post-it notes and faux postage stamps. Follow me on X for daily Sowell quotes and to connect with other fans of You Know Who. For now, just sit back and enjoy this violin version of Billy Joel's Honesty, performed by Shiki. I'm Alan Wolin. Thanks for listening.